Matt Gantry, I Died Twice, author of The Gamer. Matt Gantry's journey is one of resilience, transformation, and the power of storytelling. Once a truck driver navigating the open roads, his life took an unexpected turn after a devastating accident that forced him to redefine his future. Rather than letting adversity define him, Matt embraced writing as a means of healing, ultimately becoming the author of The Gamer, a thrilling story that blends his passion for gaming with his own life experiences. To quote Matt, "Writing became my way of processing everything, the pain, the uncertainty, the new reality I had to face. I never expected it to become something more, but storytelling gave me a purpose I never saw coming." End quote. The Gamer by Matt Gantry is a gripping novel that tells the story of Harry Fern, a video game enthusiast with a love for the SAS, the Special Air Service, who finds himself in a real-life hostage situation. Drawing on his gaming skills, Harry navigates the dangerous scenario using his strategic thinking and quick reflexes to outsmart the terrorists. The book, inspired by Gantry's own life experiences, including the accident that led him to pursue writing, seamlessly weaves action, suspense, and personal growth into a high-stakes narrative. Matt's journey from truck driver to author wasn't just about personal reinvention. It was about finding a voice and sharing a story that resonates. His dedication to storytelling has now led him to expand The Gamer into a six-part series, as well as an audiobook adaptation that brings his world to life in a whole new way. And I personally really loved the audiobook. Matt lives by the belief that even the most unexpected challenges can lead to extraordinary transformations. His work is a testament to the idea that resilience, creativity, and passion can open doors we never imagined. And a personal thank you from me to you, Matt. Thank you for sending me a copy of your book. You can find Matt at the show links below, mattgantry.com, that's two T's, on Instagram, Matt Gantry Author, and his book, The Gamer, at amazon.co.uk. Thanks for watching.
I'm Damian Porter, former New Zealand Special Forces operator, subject matter expert from HowNotToDieGuy.com. And you're listening to my Straight Talk Mind and Muscle podcast, sponsored by State, the ultimate daily formula for optimum hormone health, stress management, energy, and performance. 100% natural and clinically proven ingredients. Provides everything you need to raise your game in a convenient gut-friendly capsule. And my new sponsor, Michael Mason of the Mason Survival Protocol. Links for my former shows are in the show notes below. Thanks for watching. And we're live. Welcome to the Straight Talk Mind and Muscle podcast. Welcome to my guest tonight, and it's daytime over where you are in the UK. Matt Gantry, author of The Gamer, and I'm lucky enough to have a version of that here. Matt, welcome to the show. Thanks for your patience and thanks for coming on.
Quite all right. Nice to be you welcome, Dudley.
Hey, really good to have you on. I love the book. You were kind enough to send a copy out here. I managed to get through the audio book and it was phenomenal. You've got a hell of a story though. And I say it to people when I talk about the podcast, I interview the best people in the world of what they do. You've written a book about essentially a special forces event, and it's brilliant. I've read a lot of them. One of my good friends, Jamie Pennell, just put one out the other day about his 18 years in the regiment. But you've written a book about this and haven't got that background. So I'd like to touch off for listeners, what made you become an author? And then from there, what made you get inspired to write such a book?
Well, to throw the story back all the way to 2007, yep. I had an accident in a HGV I was driving. It was 26 ton rigid. I passed out behind the wheel through an event called cough syncope, which if you are overweight and you're coughing a lot and I used to smoke out a chest infection. I didn't know I did at the time, but I thought it was a cough. And you can cough yourself unconscious. Particularly, wow. More so in men than women. I'm not sure if they were, I'm guessing it must do, but men. And I wasn't wearing a seatbelt because I was 22, I was young as hard, I was stupid. And I passed out on a bend and went three quarters around that bend and then hit a tree that was basically right in front of me. Before I got to the tree, they were doing ditch work, digging out ditches. And yeah. There was temporary traffic lights. And when I sat at the temporary traffic lights, when it was on red, an ambulance passed me going the other way. Just had to turn around. So it was like minutes, about 5 minutes or even less, it was back there with me.
Wow.
I kind of, when I went into the tree, if you imagine this, the truck's this big, well, this, but where I'm sitting is the tree. I hit it, it's dead on. So perfect, the police thought it might have been a suicide attempt.
Yeah.
And they asked my parents at the time, what my state of mind was at the time. And they said, no, he loves driving trucks, he's wanting to do this forever.
So, did the fireys come and cut you out as well?
Yeah, there was basically, when I went up in the air, as soon as I hit the tree, hit the truck or inside of the truck against the tree because he was right in front of me, came down again. Then all the dashboard and engine came in, trapped my left leg. And I'd also, when I came down from going up in the air, the gears that pierced my left leg, straight through my leg. Then so people turned up, were the ambulance was first on the scene. That was then joined by two more fire engines, one with a local retaining station. I knew three of the four lads that were on it.
Yeah.
They're good mates, even better mates now. One fire engine came from Leicester Central, which is about 10, 12 miles away, and that had a winch fit to had to drag the truck back off the tree. And the fire service pickup truck arrived with all the DeWalt cutting gear that they needed. I mean, this was nearly 17 years ago, so the technology wasn't as good. I mean, they said themselves, we went through seven DeWalt batteries cutting you out. Now we're going through it like a knife through butter.
Oh, yeah, it's completely different now. And every truck, at least where we are, has all that gear on every truck, not just different specialist trucks.
Yeah. So, and then there were another two fire engines, sorry, another two ambulances, so three ambulances in total, one of which housed a hospital trauma team, which was sent from Leicester Royal to keep me alive at the scene of the crash.
Wow.
Plus an air ambulance. So yeah. The helicopter landed, and they carry a specialist trauma doctor. Now, just to touch on it, on the way the air ambulance works. In this country, the air ambulance is purely charity funded by donations. They don't necessarily want to be government funded because then they'll have targets to hit and stuff like that. The life's a life, no matter, you know, no matter who you save, it's a life. The paramedics have to be super fit, and they, I think it's a 2 in 6 week road to the work on the air ambulance. So 4 weeks are on the road, two in the air. And the doctors, who are all very highly trained casualty doctors and trauma doctors, they work for free on the days off.
Oh, wow. Wow, I didn't realise that. I mean, we see the Yorkshire rescue helicopters on the telly here, and that's really interesting to watch.
Well, the Yorkshire Air Ambulance, they, I believe, this may not, this is back a couple of years old, but they bought their helicopter. So when it broke down, they didn't have a helicopter. Because Warwickshire and Northamptonshire Air Ambulance, who came to my crash, they leased their helicopters. So when it breaks down, you get another one, just get another one sent to you. And they were actually covering a lot of the Yorkshire helicopter, Yorkshire ambulance, when it was theirs without service.
Yeah,
so the air ambulance, well, there was another couple of paramedic cars or doctor cars at my crash site. And then numerous police cars, a few police bikes, and a riot van ferrying policemen or police officers into the site of the crash.
Sounds hectic.
It was
the just because I do want to direct this for the listeners. You've had a hell of a crash, and I'm so lucky that I know some of your story as well. The injuries were really severe when you got to hospital, because you literally said the trauma team kept you alive at the scene of the crash. So your injuries were quite severe.
While I was in the truck, before they could do anything, they had to pull the truck away from the tree. And they said to the doctor in the air ambulance, and Gary, who was one of the first, who was the first paramedic in the ambulance passed me, he lives 6 miles up the road, I've seen him about. They were in the truck cab with me. And the fire service, you need to get out, we're going to pull winch the truck off the tree. And they said, no, we're all right, we'll stay. And they said, no, you get out. And I imagine they said something like, think of your family, something might break, snap, you aren't get injured or die, or whatever. And they said, no, it's all right, we'll stay with the patient. And they, for that action, they got a commendation from the ambulance service, which is like a Victoria Cross of the ambulance service.
Wow. So just with your action and things for everybody else, if I just translate a little bit, you're saying that the paramedics stayed with you while the fire brigade moved your vehicle.
Yeah, they were in the cab of the truck with me when the truck was being winched away from the
And
tree.
just to paint a picture for the listeners and the viewers, that's quite crucial because the patient can go downhill at any time, and the last thing you want is somebody coming in and out. You want that once that paramedic basically gets to you, they stay with you if they can the whole time. But that's quite a high risk situation is moving that truck. So just painting that picture for the listeners.
So the fire service then cut me out, and it was a long process.
Yeah.
I was trapped in the truck for 3 hours.
Oof, long time.
After in 2.5 hours, this happened twice, my heart stopped. So the doctor and paramedic from the ambulance were able to inject me with adrenaline to restart my heart. But carry on cutting, then it happens again.
Is that from blood loss
And
that was occurring?
I don't think it was blood loss. I've not got a clue. I never had a blood transfusion or anything like that.
Yep.
So I think it was just trauma.
Yep.
I'm just complete wearing down of all my body. And then, it happened again. And the doctor and the paramedic go, restart my heart. And the doctor said to the air ambulance crew, sorry, to the fireman, bear in mind, I know three of them. He said, "You've got 5 minutes to get him out of this truck. I'm going to amputate his left leg."
Wow, yep.
That was what was keeping me in the vehicle because there was a gear stick through it, and it was all trapped, broke my foot and ankle. So that was all messed up as well. So they got me out, put me in the back of the truck. They cut the back of the cab out, pulled me into the back of the curtain slider, stabilized me as best they could, but I was still a mess. I was then put on the air ambulance. Where I crashed to the Wolseley Hospital in Coventry, 9 miles in a straight line. Traveling that helicopter cruise at 190 miles per hour, flat out at 200. I was there in 5 minutes.
Brilliant.
I then went into a 5.5 hour brain operation because I've got a blood clot on my brain there, got a plastic plate there. I was then in an intensive HDU, the high dependency unit, critical care, for about a month. I had basically broken my left leg, sorry, my left foot, my left ankle, my left knee, kneecap. The gear stick had gone through my left leg. One of the lungs, this lung collapsed in operation. I fractured my skull there, all around my head, and I broke a lot of my brain. And I also had, because of the chest infection, which I didn't know was a chest infection, I had dangerously high temperature, and my red white blood cell count was absolutely wrong.
Yeah, of course.
So I was lying down in bed. There was wet towels on me to bring my temperature down. The fan was on me. The window was open. It was November, end of November in England, which is cold. And there was ice bags packed all around me.
Yeah.
And my blood was coming out of my body via the ice into kidney dialysis and back again.
Wow. Wow. Do you remember any of this?
No, I just remember from what I've seen. But what's interesting is when you've got a loved one in hospital, say talk to him or her, they might hear you. You don't hear it directly, but someone's been talking to you because I woke up knowing I'd had a crash.
Right.
I thought my boss's pickup truck, not his 26-ton huge truck.
Yeah.
Loads of people, because it's a pretty tight-knit community where I live, a little village or a small town. And everyone knew about it.
Yeah.
Everyone knew about it. Everyone knows who I am, but I don't know who half people I talk to. All right, who's that fella there? Everyone sent cards, letters. I got cards from the pubs, everyone signed the card. And my mum read these to me every single day. I was in, put into an induced coma after
Right,
the accident. So
because
that's
of
when I was in
the brain
bed.
injury.
They left all the brakes for a few days to the blood clot they did straight away. That took 5.5 hours. But they left the broken foot, ankle, knee, a few days just to let the trauma wear off. And I was in this induced coma, and my mum read the cards and all that. A couple of people sent letters. And I woke up knowing that I'd done something. Now, I read the cards and letters for the first time in February. And this was November, so I was still in hospital in February. And I used to be an assistant Cub Scout leader. And I read this letter from the Scout leader.
Yeah.
And I read it, I thought, well, I already know that. This has already happened, surely. It wasn't. I'd taken it in subconsciously while I was in the coma. Because my mum read it again and again every single day,
yeah,
I knew parts of that letter.
Wow. That's amazing how the brain works, isn't it? I'm doing the times tables with my little boy at the moment, and it's the same thing. We're not doing maths, we're doing words, and the subconscious holds those words in. Now, how long was it between the accident and you deciding to write a book? What was the time frame there?
I was in the hospital 3.5 months, a month on an induced coma, 6 weeks on a neurosurgery ward, and then another month in a different hospital closer to me, which actually turned out to be further away, it took longer to get to. I then started to write my memoirs. I spent 16 months going to physiotherapy every week and then once every 2 weeks for 16 months as an outpatient. And I couldn't work under anything this time. So I then started to write my memoirs as about the accident and stuff. And then I thought, well, I don't want to do this. I've moved on. It's still in the cupboard somewhere now behind me. But, yeah. I then wrote a book, which I won't even talk about. It was published on Kindle because Amazon weren't printing then. And that sold 600 copies, but it was priced really low. And it's garbage, if I'm honest. The writing is great. The proofreader. Well, I stupidly asked my dad. I said, what's the difference between where and where? Which one? He goes, oh, just use W-H-E-R-E for everything.
Oh, no.
And I know he can't spell, but...
You're delving into writing. You dabbled in your memoirs, wasn't pushing your buttons. You've gone and written a quick book that you said you published on Kindle. I interviewed Paul Baxendale, training partner of Dorian Yates, a few months ago. Him with life changing injury, exactly the same as you, bodybuilding champion, and he broke his back, broke his legs and hips and so on, and he went to become a master's in history, literature, and philosophy. Phenomenal. But he started using his brain like he did with his body.
Yeah.
You're delving into the writing side of things here. Why do you think that is? Because you weren't a writer. You're a truck driver who was smoking and overweight. So what happened here?
I was all right at English at school. I got a B grade in GCSE English when I was 16. So I wasn't bad at it, I was brilliant, but I knew more than the average C grade.
Yeah.
But I think over the years since the accident, I've done 11 different jobs and not worked out, mainly because of my injuries and stuff like that. I can't, physical ones, I can't stand up for more than an hour without my foot hurting because of it. My mobility isn't as good, my ankle doesn't, the inversion and eversion on my foot isn't there because I've got pins in it. I'll get a tennis elbow in this elbow 8 times.
Yep. So the injuries are really dragging you down, but the book of things. So is that what made you decide to go down that route?
It was just probably out of boredom in a way. Not really not boredom, but just something to do.
Yes.
And it's something that I deeply enjoy doing. I really do love making. You write a sentence, you think, hang on, it worked better if you did it that way around and change that, and then add a bit on, and then soon enough, you've got a paragraph, and then after a few paragraphs, you've got a page, and then you've got 2,500 words later, you've got a chapter. And I enjoy the research side of it as well, and annotating that research into the written word.
Brilliant.
But the idea for the book came when I was about 13 or 14 years old. I read, as Harry does in this book, he reads his dad's copy of Bravo 2-0 about the SAS patrol behind enemy lines during the First Gulf War. And it all goes to pot, and they have to basically do a runner. I read that, loved it, and then read Chris Ryan's The One That Got Away.
Yep.
And then I read all their fiction stuff, and then read more stuff. Brilliant book, brilliant. Sniper One by Sergeant Dan Mills, which is about them in Alamara in Iraq. They were a sniper platoon, and they had to defend the Simic House. It was, I think, it was the longest prolonged siege since Zulu for the British Army.
Wow, that does sound interesting.
Phenomenal book. So I read all this stuff, and when I was like maybe 15, I'd be on the school bus, and I think, well, be in school, and I think, what would I do if terrorists came in the school? Or what would I do if terrorists stormed the hotel when I was on holiday? What would I do if this, that, and the other? And I used to think like that when I was bored in school, and I meant to be concentrating. I'd be thinking, well, hang on, if terrorists came through that door, I'm going to lift this table, throw it at him, then run on there and clobber him, get his gun, then I can get it. But to the idea, you know, it's years old. It just took over 20 years to put it into the idea of a video game and doing the same with the skills he'd learned video gaming. Yeah. And I had all this idea. I had a few things in my head going around. And I said to my friend's son, who's now a friend as well, and he was 14 at the time, I said, I've got this idea for a book about a video gamer in a hostage situation using his skills from video gaming to shoot terrorists. And really goes, oh, that sounds sick. So that's why I thought it was a goer. And his name was Harry Fern.
Yeah, it's a great book. I've tried to lead the listeners and the viewers through your story from the accident, or from prior to the accident and then to the book. And I remember when you first sent it to me, I'm well known and probably very bad at it for paraphrasing a bunch of things. But really, I thought, Matt, that accident in some way had rewired your brain. And I say that in such a great way because it's turned you into an author. But your book is unique, because you're such a details person in the book and laying your journey there. But in the book, it's not annoying. It actually adds to it. And I've read a lot of these books, and I'm lucky enough to get sent from many people of the world. But it's really intriguing the way you go into the details there, and your brain's very specific on it. So is that what happened? Is that did your brain change its format for being able to do this?
It's interesting you should mention that, because I don't think I wasn't necessarily a details person before, but whenever we have a conversation in the pub and someone asks me, says, what have you been doing today? I'll give them a full rundown from 6 o'clock when I got up, got a spinning bike, had a shower, went to the gym, came home, did water dog, whatever. I'll give them they're all like, Jesus, you could have just said our usual day. I'll give them a full breakdown of everything I've done. But yeah, I think as well with the book and the details, because it's the first one of this character, the first one in this series, my first proper book ever, really. Not the other one was rubbish. I needed to set the scene. So when I've gone into the history of the SAS and other special forces, I'm setting the scene.
Yeah.
And then I'm now 56,000 words into the sequel. And I haven't had to do that, because the presumption would be that everyone's read the first book, and I'm leaving bits in the second book that refer to the first book, so they'll have to go and read that anyway. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting with series of books. Vince Flynn comes to mind. I've forgotten the main hero or character in that. And some of the other operators' books, like Chris Ryan, Ollie Ollerton even. But I do notice in there they've got to reference back in case it's they're on book 15, but in case the reader's picked up book 15 and not read any of the 14 prior. So it must be quite difficult as an author to do a sequels. Now, the gamer, with the details guy that you are, that would be amazing to see on the screen. It was great as an audio book, but to see on the screen with those details, that would jump out at you. You know, John Wick's a classic detail sort of movie, but geez, it would be great to see that come out eventually on the screen.
I've done 80,000 words. It's a screenplay for a 6-part Amazon or Netflix or whatever television series.
Yep.
Because a friend from the village, he's directed a few films, not massive one, and Ben Cooks, and I think he did Waiting for Anya, is one of his. And that was the film of a book by Michael Mapergo. Now, I spoke to him and he said, no, don't do it like that. I said, because he has no one in the right mind is going to read a 2.5 hour long screenplay. He said, break it up. Didn't really write it that long, but break it into individual chapters. So yep. It's for the television drama or whatever. So that's what I did. I wanted to do that because I wanted, if you look at the Day of the Jackal.
Yep.
The book, the film is very closely related to the book.
Yep, it is. I've read both, read the book and seen the movie, yeah.
Because I've seen the movies, I couldn't get halfway into the book and I just couldn't do it because I knew what was going to happen, but which is a shame. But I wanted to keep following so closely, so I made it into six part series rather than a 2 hour film. But what was interesting about writing it is where the scenes, if you remember right at the start of the book, Harry's walking home from school.
Yep.
And he's using his SAS light, so he's walking, and he's looking in the mirror. So he's looking in the shop window for reflection of who's following him.
Yep, I remember that exact scene.
That doesn't translate to movies. So that to do it, so his friend he's walking home with, he's still walking with him, and he explains it to her, and she goes, "Oh my god, yeah, I know what you mean now."
Right.
And then I made a few scenes up about where the special forces are training next door in the hotel. Because in the book, I can just say they are, but you need to see it on screen. But yeah, that was as the book took 3 years, 2 years to write, a year to edit, the screenplay took about 60 days and I've done it.
Yeah, you've got all the content there. That's interesting. It's intriguing from, I've interviewed a few Special Forces guys that have gone on to become authors. And I think the first one it is, I literally said the question, what the hell inspired you to write a book? Because it's so far from what we do, you know, pulling triggers, so far from what you did, you know, driving a truck. But for me to hear you say, Matt, you know, it took you 2 years to write the book and a year to edit. Gosh, that's a passion project, and that's perseverance.
Yeah, it was 2 years to write it, and I was working at the same time, and then the company, who I won't mention, but mentioned in the book, actually, in the last chapter. So you have to buy the book now to find out who I was talking about. They have 120 lads on the firm. We're draymen, delivering beer to pubs, clubs, race courses, whatever, anywhere that sells alcohol or serves alcohol. And there's two lads that were absolute dickheads, for want of a better term. And I just thought, you know what? I'm not putting up with this. So I went to the doctors, got a sick note for mental health or for the mental health problems they were giving me. And I was on the 6 months and I wrote. And then COVID came around.
Right.
And that obviously, people all over COVID were bored and didn't know what to do. I had something to do every single minute of every day.
Yeah,
I was researching, writing, I was maybe watching podcasts, watching documentaries or films just to get the odd little ideas and things I could twist into scenes for myself for my book. It took 2 years to edit, 2 years to write, a year to edit, and then it took another year. Me and my mate did the audiobook. Unfortunately, because he's a thespian by trade, he's an actor. He's acted with Sir Patrick Stewart for the Royal Shakespeare Company all over Europe and England, and played everything from Prince to Pauper. But he was a barman at the time, in a local pub. So we could do it on a Thursday afternoon when he finished work. Sorry, a Thursday morning before he started work, and a Friday afternoon after he finished work, because he lives about 15 miles away.
Wow.
So we used to, and then I would spend the week editing it.
Yep.
Now, I'd never done an audiobook before in my life. So I never looked at editing one. So the first chapter, we used to record 3 or 4 chapters a week over the 2 days. The first week, editing took me a week to edit that chapter. And then the next one took me another week. And then gradually, over 45 chapters, I got quicker and quicker and quicker. So I was doing 3 or 4 a day.
Right. I didn't realize there was so much editing in an audiobook. It's I hardly ever edit these shows. I've only ever had to edit a couple of things out the whole time it's been on. But your guy in the audiobook is brilliant. He comes across really well. It must be so difficult when you've got a male character and then a female character and you're narrating these different voices, and they're so clever, these actors, with their pitch range and their tone and their accents and things. So picking the right person for an audiobook is crucial.
I definitely found the right fellow. And so many people have said, I think personally, my friend Wayne, who's losing his sight, he was the inspiration for it because he can't read books. He does a lot of audiobooks.
Right.
So that's why I did, because I wanted him to read my book, or him to be able to listen to my book.
Yep.
And he said, I said, Chris is as good as, if not better than, every audiobook we've ever listened to.
Yeah, great. Yeah, it was brilliant. It hit the mark for me. I enjoyed it. I couldn't put, air quotes, couldn't put down listen or read. It was riveting. And I was just so surprised listening to it, Matt, because you sent it over and it captured me straight away. And that's why I wanted to get you on the show and celebrate that and get that message out to the listeners and the viewers. It is, it's captivating. So congratulations. I have to say that, thank you for reaching out, and congratulations on the success of the book. When is your time frame for the sequel?
Well, I started writing it more or less straight away. Then I thought, I'm going to need to write a screenplay of this. So I did the screenplay. And I must have had we wrote the book, so that was another year. Then I started writing the sequel. Then I thought screenplay, so that would say a few months. But I was on 5,000 words for a few months. And I just didn't feel it. I think writer's block doesn't exist. But it's a combination of not knowing what to write, and also you can't be bothered.
Yeah,
I just couldn't be asked to go, now I want a few months of not doing anything. And then I got it to 17,000 words. Then I got it to 33,000 words. It was at 33,000 words about 4 or 5 weeks ago. I'm now on 56,000 words. And the more research I do, the more stuff I can write about, the more. So a lot of it's just doing the research. So I'm talking to my special forces guy that I know, Tango, who is a friend's uncle. He was in Northern Ireland with the Force Research Unit based at the Lions Logs of the SAS. And his input has been invaluable. He's given me a couple of little lines of quote lines he's heard his colleagues say to, let's say, the IUC or Police Service Northern Ireland. So I've used a couple of those little lines, which I'm sure you can. When they're in the streets towards the end of the book and the dickers are being followed, take the dicker down. One of those lines that he heard one of his mates say to a Royal Ulster Constabulary police officer about pointing his gun at him. But the more research I do, the better the book will be.
And
I was speaking to him last night, we WhatsApp on each other, and I've now got, after we finish here, I can go and write 1,000 words and I won't stop because I know what I'm writing about. And it's just having that little bit of knowledge to make things valid and make them credible.
So looking at 2025 for the sequel?
Hopefully, definitely 2025, but hopefully early 2025, in the first quarter, I'll say.
Yeah. Awesome. Look, Matt, thanks so much for coming on. Thank you for sending the book over. The narrated show notes are there at the start. They've got your website. They've got the links and where to find you. And I always ask that guest at this stage as well. For the listeners and the viewers now, where's the best place to go and grab your book and find out more about you?
Amazon.co.uk or .com.au, whatever. Amazon's the best place to buy it from. And I will be next Wednesday. I'm at Sheffield University Freshers Fair. So there'll be 6,000 students in one day, all of whom can read, half of whom will read for pleasure, a lot of whom will be video gamers, some will be on video gaming degree course, and they've all just been given a whacking great student loan, the most money they've ever had in their lives, and I'm there to take off and sell them a copy of my book. So if you're in Sheffield, England, next, this will come out after that, but yeah.
I must clip that part out and post it up on the socials, because this will come out in about 6 weeks with the guests we got lined up. So I'll clip that out for you. Brilliant. It's nice to see you out there and about. you know, showing the book. And yeah, congratulations again on your success. But most importantly, congratulations on the life-changing, and a lot of people use the term post-traumatic growth you've had from your accident, Matt.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, it comes with, I had two very dark years after the accident. I thought, I read Anime Lab's book, Seven Troop. I thought, well, I'll do this, that, and I've got PTSD. And the doctor didn't agree with me. So he said, go and do something useful. So I raised £5,500 for their ambulance. Wow. And he said, I went back, he said, you haven't got, you need anger management counselling.
So you just need purpose, is what I find, man.
Yeah. Well, I had all these demons in my head. And once a week for 2 years, I thought about killing myself. Every single week, I was in such a dark place. No one to talk to. I mean, they were, but in my mind, I didn't see I had anyone to talk to. I could go from massively depressed to sky high and click a few fingers.
Jesus.
I would overreact to an action.
Yep.
So you're in the pub, someone spills your pint, you let him buy you another pint. Now this never happened, but I wouldn't do that. I would hit him, not stop hitting him until he was on the floor and blood was pouring out his ears. It was that type of rage, an extreme rage, uncontrollable. But then I got to see the person at Leicester General Hospital, and she said, you've not got PTSD, but you've got a head injury, and the side effects of a head injury and PTSD do overlap. So that's what I read about when I said I've got PTSD. I didn't have it, but I had those symptoms from the head injury.
The symptoms are there. That happens with special forces guys, from the breaching and explosions that we go through as well, so much as well, Matt, with a traumatic brain injury.
Yeah. And then from that, the woman said, you haven't got PTSD, but head injury. And it was like the clouds parted and the sun shone through. And I still feel like that occasionally, but I can deal with it because I know why.
Yes.
But not knowing is the scariest thing on this planet.
Yeah, gosh, you're preaching to the choir there, and especially from some of the guests that have been on, you're so right. Until they find what's going on, why the hell it's happening, and then find their purpose and identity, then until that happens, it's a very dark place.
And talking about finding purpose, I've done, as I said, lots of different jobs since the accident, many of which that I am unable to do physically or that kind of stuff. And I think to start with, I had two office jobs quite early on. My brain just wasn't back to functioning properly. Exactly. I couldn't think that quickly to do it. But now I've found I do something I absolutely love. And I will not rest until this book is out there in the mainstream. Absolutely huge. Because the response from literary agents was phenomenal. They're getting one response from literary agent is massive. I got 9 from 150 emails, and they all generally said, we love your book, the concept is amazing, but we can't go to a publisher with it because it's not been done before, there's no proof it will sell in the shops. So right. I thought, you know what, I'm going to disprove this theory. So that's why I've been to 58 shows in just over a year, book fairs, comic cons, etc. I think I've now sold 1,035 books. And hopefully with this Sheffield thing next week, it's going to go up by another 100.
Yeah, of course.
And then publishes all most self-published books sell a few hundred copies most.
Yeah,
because they haven't done the research, and the it doesn't look like a professional cover of the book. Whereas I've got a brilliant graphic designer who is, funnily enough, my special forces guy's stepdaughter. She's a graphic designer and she's phenomenal, as you can see her work in front of you there.
Yeah.
And the research, a lot of it was what I already knew from reading these books through 20 years of reading special forces books. And then I read another 5 books for this one book to get extra knowledge about all the special forces and top up all the bits of mine I've forgotten about.
Well, yeah. Like I said, Matt, it's brilliant. I love the book. Anybody that's listening, well worth the read, worth the listen. Really great that it's on Audible, Amazon, and so on. So good luck for the sequel. We could talk about that again, but thank you so much for your time. Thank you for coming on, and thank you for being a great author and changing direction.
Thank you very much.
You're more than welcome.
Hi, thanks for watching. I'm Damien Porter, former New Zealand Special Forces operator and former Australian police officer, and your podcast host. Please check out my new project at hownottodieguy.com, where I teach everything you need to know to both males and females, at-risk populations, schools, kids, and the elderly, for self-defense, situational awareness, and all-round skills that every good person should know. Thanks for watching.